Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. Our topic this week is service contracting within the Defense Department, something that's rarely mentioned in the public conversation about defense spending, even though services make up more than half of what DOD buys from the private sector each year. The Pentagon made a commitment to, in its terms, improve tradecraft in services acquisition back in 2010 during the first iteration of the Better Buying Power Initiative. A lot has happened since then. DOD, for example, has ordered all of its components to assign senior managers to oversee all their service contracts. And last month, the department put the work it's been doing on service contracting into a long-awaited formal policy document, DOD Instruction 5000.74. Ken Brennan has been one of the major forces behind the drafting of that instruction, and he's our guest for the full hour this week. We won't do justice to all of the intricacies of service contracting, but we'll touch on at least the high points. Brennan is DOD's Deputy Director for Procurement and Acquisition Policy for Services. I asked him what the department was trying to accomplish with the new instruction.
The standalone 5000.74 really came about for a number of reasons, primarily that services is different than the major acquisition weapon systems and IT, the MDAP and MAES. The demand is generated on a decentralized fashion. Anyone that needs services usually takes care of it at a more local level. Which generates its own individual process and roles in a vastly expanded landscape as compared to the more centralized defense acquisition workforce focus of an MDAP or MAES for the major weapon systems. So given that kind of landscape, as we looked at how we could improve our capabilities, including some inputs from the Hill, as well as our own assessments, there is definitely a difference, and the 5000.74 is designed to take those processes, document them appropriately, but still maintain flexibility that the decentralized demand warrants and ends up giving the folks out in the field, the services owners, the opportunity and flexibility to appropriately manage against a rule set without being overly onerous like the 5000.02 and an MDAP, which is rightfully aligned with the size of the procurement.
Right. And I've heard both Secretary Carter and Mr. Kendall talk repeatedly over the years about one of the points that you just made, which is this whole issue of decentralized demand and a lot of people involved in the process not really being quote-unquote acquisition professionals per se. To what extent is this an effort to get at that exact issue to sort of professionalize the acquisition of service?
I wouldn't say that it's a primary focus, but it is a very important focus. The argument that I would make about the word professionalize is we have made a conscious decision to not have an acquisition workforce based on the structure that the folks that are buying these services are, what they do, what their day jobs are, where their career fields go. So we won't have a services career field like DWEA, so it won't be professionalized in that fashion, but we are trying to professionalize the processes so that those folks who are doing services acquisition in support of their day jobs are doing all of the things that a professional services acquirer would do in accordance with set processes and repeatable capabilities, plus generate metrics so that we can actively manage services. So professionalize, yes, but not a full Defense Acquisition Workforce Improvement Act career field.
Right. And so what sorts of training have happened to date, and what kind of training do you plan for those people who are at the deck plate levels, as you said, doing service acquisition in addition to their day job?
Right. We have a number of different capabilities already developed, and we are working incorporating those into a full-on curriculum development to cover all requirements. So the things that we have available already is the Defense Acquisition University and the Army Logistics University have already developed services-related classes as training capability, not as certification for a career field, but true training events. Mm-hmm. We have already begun to leverage those capabilities in a more informal fashion. Posted on our webpage is a number of course offerings and how to register for them as well. And then we've also begun to leverage some avatar YouTube type videos developed under an Army initiative that talks about in little short vignettes about requirements development and how the requirements folks might interface with contracting officers, what market research might go into services. And while those things already do exist, we have a full-blown functional integrated product team that is looking at services acquisition writ large and developing an entire curriculum. So while I mentioned earlier that it won't be a DWEA career field, we are looking at the training that those folks would need just in time, essentially, for an acquisition in their day job. We are looking at something that's probably going to take us a couple few years to get completely developed and rolled out. But we are, again, in this for the long haul, and in an effort to not make it too onerous on the folks that are doing their day jobs that need services as an enabler, we want to do that just in time as they need it. So we won't be maintaining a certification, which is a bit of a nod to the fluidity of our workforce in the non-acquisition environments about people rotating in and out of jobs as they move through their career. They may not actually have services in the future, but they still need the training now. So we want to make sure that we can get that to them in the most beneficial, time-effective fashion.
Right. And I'm sure it's hard to characterize that entire curriculum in the context of a radio interview, but if I go to one of those classes at DAU or Army Logistics University, what are some of the most important things that you want me to learn there?
Probably the single most important thing that we want you to learn is the critical thinking that goes along with requirements development. Every service contract that we have is rooted in the definition of the requirement. Do the folks that need these services have the skill sets to put that requirement into words that is not only understandable by the customer, but also the vendor base as a potential provider, as well as can be turned into contract language that can define success and failure and measure performance into things that make a service requirement successful. So we have courses that talk about developing requirements. We have tools that are incorporated into those curriculum regarding service acquisition workshops, which are a facilitated development of service requirements. We have tools that are incorporated into the training that talk about what language to use and how to develop a traceable performance work statement. So the curriculum exist in the SAW art and requirements development capability, which is also under the ALU course, that we think is probably the most important thing to get off on the right foot in the start of a service requirement.
In your view, has that weakness in defining requirements been the biggest weakness in DoD's past procurements of services?
I believe that it has. The challenges that we've seen are traceable eventually back to the requirement. We have seen requirements that are so broad that they're not necessarily tightly interpreted and allow mission creep or mission growth, regardless of whether or not that is in the department or the mission executor's best interest. And I think that part of that was facilitated by some of the budget developments post 9/11. It was very much a focus on mission. It was not as much focus on the cost or the schedule. Now, as we begin to come away from that particular point, we begin to balance cost, schedule, and performance for services. Defining the requirements is an important skill set that is really needed to be effective as we move forward.
We're talking this week with Ken Brennan, DOD's Deputy Director for Procurement and Acquisition Policy for Services. A lot more to come this hour about the details of how DOD is trying to improve its management of service contracting through functional domain experts and component-level leads. More on that in just a few minutes. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Ken Brennan is our guest this week as we talk about DOD's attempts to improve its management of service contracts. He's in charge of services within the Office of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. Mr. Brennan is helping us unpack DOD Instruction 5000.74, the first comprehensive policy the department's ever put together to handle service acquisition in the same rigorous way it does with ships, planes, and other products that one could argue are about as complex as the services realm that DOD deals with these days.
So getting back to the new instruction, some of the keys in there are the creation of these things called functional domain experts and component level leads. Can you take us through what each one of those are and what functions they'll serve in services acquisition?
The functional domain expert is a construct that is somewhat parallel to what you may have seen in the federal sector just recently rolled out as category manager. Right. These folks are expert in their field that consume services in support of that mission. We have a functional domain expert that does transportation and logistics who sits in the transportation policy shop. So they are experts in that capability. Their tasking is to identify the requirements owners, identify best practices, see if they can identify redundancies and eliminate them, maybe through strategic sourcing or additional category management, and then develop metrics and standardized processes as appropriate for that function. And the reason that we divided it into functions is we recognize that the services procured and the demand, plus the way the market provides those, differ amongst portfolios. Mm-hmm. You get and need medical services different than you do transportation, different than you do knowledge-based, say, engineering services or maintenance services. So we've divvied that up against our taxonomy, have a dozen different categories against which we track, and are working on doing those kinds of things that I just described, which are laid out in our actual appointment memo for the FDEs. The component-level lead is a compatriot thought process and responsibility, but it's actually resonant in the MILDEP or the component. Mm. So while we have a single overarching FDE for each of these taxonomies, each component is expected to determine whether or not it's appropriate for them to have a component level lead that is essentially looking at the same kinds of things, but is also a conduit to executing the FDE direction within their component. So it's forming a team with the FDE in the lead, with the next level down of component level leads to bring forth all the things that I just described, best practices, metrics, market intelligence, et cetera, to develop the best practices, the policy focus, the direction, the leadership vision of how to manage that taxonomy portfolio or portfolio group. So they fit hand in glove. The component level leads definitely just a lower level at the individual component, MILDEP or Fourth Estate component.
Just so I understand, are the functional domain experts, are they simply experts in the field of, let's say, transportation and logistics, or specifically in contracting for services in that field?
No, it was specifically chosen that they are experts in that field, okay, not contracting for services in that field. And that is definitely a nod to the fact that acquisition of services is not necessarily a contracting problem. Granted, there is always a contract when you contract for services, but the issues that we have seen arise and the focus that we're trying to put on it are about the actual requirements in support of the mission. So the folks that we chose, experts in their field, have probably dealt with contracting for those services, but were not picked because they were experts in services contracting.
Gotcha. And you just used the past tense, so I take that to mean that you've already appointed these FDEs and the component level leads?
Yes. In an effort to be as transparent as possible, we posted the appointment letter on our webpage. The appointment letter was originally in October of 13, and we are updating it now to reflect some potential taxonomy changes as well as personnel changes.
The structure's been in place for a while. Any key takeaways so far or areas for improvement? Or some of those, I would imagine, are probably reflected in the instruction.
They are, actually. And the instruction was in staffing for a goodly while. In fact, the FDEs, dating back to October of 13, has been up and running even before the signature on the 5th of January of 16. So these things have been working. It has been very challenging, the FDE concept, because of the decentralized demand, trying to understand the tens of thousands of contracts and literally millions of contract transactions and how that relates to the myriad of requirements that are underneath that. We are struggling with data sets. We are trying to get connected with the largest buyers, and it's not necessarily discernible using some of the data sets that we have, most notably Federal Procurement Data System Next Generation. So we've been working on that. There are some areas of successes. We did agree to track at the portfolio level certain metrics as it related to competition and small business utilization within service sectors. Mm-hmm. So we are doing that using some internal capabilities based off of FPDSNG. And we think that that's going to continue to pay off in improved capabilities for services. But as far as some of the larger best practices, the transparency that is the vision, we're still a little ways away from that. But we do have good teaming arrangements between the FDEs and the CLLs, some excellent ones in some cases. And we think that this is going to continue to build.
And so what's the connectivity or communication between the FDE all the way down to those decentralized requirements holders at a garrison somewhere in Texas? I mean, how do they communicate with one another? And what's the FDE's main role there? Is it to mostly communicate best practices? Here's how you go by. Well, you said they're not experts in acquisition. So what is their role in terms of advising?
Their role is predominantly a one-way communication to the individual buyers and consumers of services, so both contracting and requirements owners. We hope to have a vision implemented to where you've got communities of interest and best practices web page, and maybe even some policies. And we have an example of a policy that's being developed regarding IT services and how those should be bought under category management. Very similar in the functional domain. So as the folks gather up and identify best practices, we get that onto a resource tool access, be it public web page, be it incorporated into DAU curriculum, be it incorporated into tips and tricks for the acquisition community. The other way, coming back up the chain, I think that it will be a tiered structure somewhat similar to the chain of command in the acquisition, that if the requirements owner at Camp Swampy has got an issue regarding this type of service, that it works its way up to say, hey, I found this or I have this challenge. Are there resources that can be engaged to help me through that and or pass this improvement lesson up, you know, form consideration and incorporation into the FDE? That's a long way away from now, from where we sit, but that is the ultimate vision.
And so when you're a local requirements owner and you're facing a particular challenge, you know, in most cases, DOD is a big place. Somebody's probably faced a similar challenge and overcome it before. Are there mechanisms for communication in that way from past experience of one requirements owner or acquirer to another?
Yeah, there is. And the senior services managers in the MILDEPs and some of the fourth estate components are that conduit to connect those users to each other. They're also, I think, a great conduit to identify those areas where strategic sourcing vehicles already exist, as well as to connect expertise not only within the individual department, but through the SSM structure, the FDE structure, to other areas inside and even outside of DOD.
Ken Brennan is the Deputy Director for Services in the Office of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. We'll talk more after another quick break. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. Back on federalnewsradio.com in 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. We're talking this week with Ken Brennan, the Deputy Director for Services in the Office of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy, mostly about the new instruction DOD just issued about services contracting.
The instruction talks about should cost management. Take us through a little bit about how the department envisions that being applied to services, and is it really different than the way it works in the product world where you've had a few years of experience on this?
Yeah, should cost in services is significantly different, and it was one of the areas during staffing that we wrestled with the language. The should cost within MDAP, there's policy out there that's been incorporated, talks about the rates and the overheads and improvements in innovation and efficiencies and capabilities. Services should cost, to boil it down, really is about what are the things that I can afford versus the benefit that it brings. I hate to overly simplify it, but it kind of comes down to the plain English of what should this cost? What am I willing to pay for that capability? And do I understand that capability well enough to understand and make a decision that I either A, want to spend this much more to get additional capability, or if I ratchet back my scope a little bit, I can save this much money. And it's that mindset about what do I need? What can I afford? What should this really cost in services, which really affects the requirements and the scope much more than the should cost discussion in the major weapon systems and MAES.
Right. And so getting back to your point about data, one of the things I would imagine that you would want is some better historical prices paid data from across the government in determining what something should cost, yes?
That is one of the data points that we are looking at. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too enamored with the data yet because we're still talking about the requirements as defined prior to the 5,000.74. As opposed to those that are being evaluated against the thought processes that 0.74 brings to bear. Mm. So when we may have had a statement of work that said, provide all capability for base support X, the should cost discussion, while we know what we paid for that, should really be focused in on, okay, when we say all of this support, what does that include? And what is the value of those things? Then we talk about cost. So there was an example years ago where folks started taking out their own trash. As far as value, is that a good requirement? You would argue potentially that it's not. But then when you really compared it to the cost, it's truly not, because you can do it a whole lot cheaper rather than have your engineers and your executive vice presidents taking out their own trash. So while we do want data, we want to make sure that we've got the right pricing data that we can segregate it into understanding each individual requirement within the broader scope of the umbrella.
Right. So if I'm understanding you right, in the sort of post 5,000.74 world, are we going to have more consistent contract language and requirements across the department, theoretically?
I do believe that we will have more consistent language and requirements, because we have been the 800-pound gorilla in asking for services, and there has been no shortage of people that would provide us whatever we wanted. And we are now very much attuned to the fact that while they'll give us that, that's not necessarily the best value for the warfighter or the taxpayer. And back to my 2x4 example, if I ask for 2 inches by 4 inches, someone will give it to me and I will pay 3 times as much as I could if I just bought what was off the shelf. So that standardized language that aligns to how the market provides it and takes into account the uniqueness or lack thereof of what we're trying to purchase, we probably will see more standardization in requirements language. That said, we're certainly still allowing the additional flexibility where a unique requirement is needed, that folks have the opportunity for that flexibility.
As you sort of alluded to, a lot of contracts out there that were written prior to the issuance of this instruction. Talk a bit, if you can, about what's being done to make sure there's still a valid requirement for all those contracts that have built up over the years and potential for weeding out some unnecessary ones.
Right. The biggest focus on that area is a concept that was actually codified in statute, the Service Requirements Review Board. Mm-hmm. In the DoD, that's Enclosure 5, and it is born out of a capability originally called Contracts Court to where an appropriate level of leadership evaluates every requirement as it relates to mission capability, marginal cost, and marginal contributions so that they can assess whether those requirements are still valid. The MILDEPS started this years ago. In fact, I think it was 2012, I believe, the Navy held the very first contracts court ever. It evolved in process, name, and capability into a Service Requirements Review Board. And the fourth estate, the non-MILDEPS, are executing their process for the very first time this fiscal year. We have identified full contracts, full capabilities, full requirements that were stopped because they were either redundant, which was the primary reason, or unneeded, or just not a high priority compared to some of the other service requirements that were needed by that review board entity.
So redundancy among individual contracts, are you also starting to run across big obvious redundancies between contract vehicles, and are there opportunities to cut out some of that duplication if there is any?
There are. And there's actually a great example that we came across. We were actually in a facility that the facility owner was supposed to provide security and infrastructure support to. And it wasn't even a contract, actually. It was a government-to-government discussion. And when we did the review of the requirements that were being contracted for, we identified that we were paying a third party, a contracted party, to provide those same capabilities that were already part of the lease agreement. We eventually got to asking the questions, and the answers came back that, ooh, we're actually paying a third party to do something that someone else has already agreed to do, so don't do the part that's redundant. Hold the first party accountable to actually provide those capabilities. Also to more the crux of your question, I think, is regarding strategic sourcing. We have a lot of different contract vehicles out there providing similar, if not exactly the same types of services. And a part of the standardization discussion, both in requirements and contract capability, we have tried to get folks to get onto some of these vehicles so that they don't have to invest contracting officers, requirements owners, labor to stand up a parallel, seemingly redundant capability. So strategic sourcing is definitely part of that.
Gotcha. Do you have any specific targets in mind as to levels of savings that you might be able to wring out of that, or what's even realistic based on the experience of the MILDEPS?
Right. We have certain expectations that we have identified via MILDEP execution anywhere from about 12 to 25% of requirements that could be eliminated or restructured to provide savings for the next unfunded priority. So while we do have those kinds of targets, we are trying to allow the owners the ability to identify them and reprogram them as such. So we don't put into the DOTI any specific numbers, but we do have goals in mind as it relates to how we want to execute this. One of the goals that has been codified is in the Fourth Estate's Service Requirements Review Board. In our guidance, we're actually looking to identify 10% of the requirement that can be evaluated against reducing that amount and what risk is manifested. And then, based on those discussions about risk, the question will then be answered by the requirements owner: do I want to take that risk and move on to my next unfunded priority, or is that risk too high and do I want to just keep doing what we're doing, perhaps with a change in management structure to manage that risk? So while we're talking about goals and we're talking about efficiencies and the numbers are pretty big, we are trying to allow the executors of the process, the requirements owners, to make those decisions in an informed manner as they do their service requirements review board.
So it sounds like, you know, instead of go find 10% of savings and then we're going to take your money away, it's here's a way to find out your actual requirements and then you can keep the savings for higher priorities. Is
correct.
That about right?
Correct. There is still some concerns about the fact that we've got bills to pay as our budget is coming down, and there is the potential that they might be repurposed to buy that bill down. But currently, our guidance is you identify it, you can repurpose it.
Got it. And just to be clear, you said the MLDEPs showed, I think, 12 to 25% of potential requirements cut. Did they actually achieve that, or was that just what they identified as potential?
What they did was they identified it as potential, and while we believe that they did achieve it in contract restructuring, we do not have the data tracking like we're trying to develop in the Fourth Estate to validate that those numbers actually did come to pass. I was still with the Navy when they did theirs, and I know that they restructured the contracts, they got rid of deliverables that were being unused. Those things did come to pass, but I don't have a data set that said organization A identified requirement 7 and saved 18% and then put it on to requirement 14. But we are working that kind of tracking in the Fourth Estate right now.
That's Ken Brennan, the Deputy Director for Services in the Office of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. He'll join us for a few more minutes to talk about DoD services contracting after one more break this hour. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serville. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. We're back with Ken Brennan, the Deputy Director for Services in the Office of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy, as we talk about DoD's new instruction for services acquisition.
Are there any implications in the instruction for how DoD handles or doesn't handle either insourcing of work or outsourcing of work to new contractors? I believe there's a line in there somewhere that says that work basically shall not be contracted that is currently being done by a civilian, if I've got that right. Is it basically a complete forbidding of any further outsourcing?
The instruction is really just a reflection of 10 U.S.C. 2461 and is not a standalone comment about the acceptability or viability of who should be doing what work. It is reflective of the statutory language. If those things were to change, we would certainly look to change the DoTI to reflect the full spectrum of authorities granted to us in accordance with the statute.
Gotcha. But bottom line, this is not a DoD policy. It's just doing what Congress told you to do.
Correct.
Essentially. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned IT services briefly before, very big area, obviously. Are there special implications for IT services specifically in the instruction? How are they treated differently, if at all?
There is implications on IT services, so much so that the enclosure that governs those IT services, number 7, was primarily written by the DoD CIO with our help. To reflect their market base, their capabilities, and their mission. IT services has its own uniqueness as it relates to the vast explosion of how much IT there is in running the day-to-day world, including the DoD, of course. So to address that and how quickly that market is moving, it did get its own enclosure.
Can you say a little bit about how IT services are different from knowledge-based services, other kinds of services that are covered in the instruction? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be a bit of an oversimplification, but the IT services that we procure are being provided by a customer base that only limitedly relies on us as customers. So the IT services provided to the world. Wireless phones and servers and cloud and personal email and work emails and those type things. The DoD is really not a driver in a lot of the commercial off-the-shelf services that we buy in IT. We are in some cases, but in general, the market is driving the capability rather than us. So coupled with cybersecurity and how we keep all of our systems secure, the IT provides a unique opportunity or limitation in some cases on how to set the requirements. Contrasted with, say, knowledge-based services in procuring engineering and design, we are actually a major driver in some of those categories. And we're the only shipbuilders, as an example, in the United States for warships. And actually, I don't think we have any cruise ships being built here any longer either. So it's either very small or it's us in shipbuilding. So getting a naval architect is a base that we drive. IT is not really the same way because we're just a small portion of the entire IT customer base that the industry is reacting to.
Right. And of course, this gets even more complicated because I think in at least some or maybe most major automated information systems, you're buying services and products at the same time, all in one contract. So in a big procurement like that, is that a product award or a services award that falls under all the new rules we're talking about here?
Right now, it is based on the categorization of the contract based on the preponderance of the product service code. So if the preponderance of that contract is hardware, it will receive a single PSC that is coded for the hardware and would be managed as hardware. We are working on a capability in data by tracking this at the contract line item, so that while you will classify a contract with one PSC, each individual contract line item will be identified as its own capability. So if you're buying IT services, it would get coded as a service, even though the major contract may be a hardware contract. And we will begin to focus in on managing those services as they relate to the larger requirement. Right now, we've got kind of this all or nothing mode about the one PSC per contract requirement. Mm-hmm. As we begin to drill down into the contract line item, we'll be able to have more granularity and better management, we think, of the actual line item and manage those appropriately according to whichever side they fall on.
Gotcha. One thing we haven't talked about yet is small business. The instruction specifically calls out that it's an objective to maximize small business utilization and services. Any specific plans on how you're going to tackle that?
We do, actually. And as it turns out, in services, we do a significant portion of our business with small business. Mm-hmm. The department met its goal for small business execution, and we recognize that in our spend analysis that as large primes develop weapons systems, those aren't even capable of being met by small businesses. Only the large businesses can build aircraft carriers, as an example. So when we did our spend analysis in services, we have seen a significantly larger footprint percentage-wise in the services sector being provided by small businesses. The FDE agreement to track small business within those portfolios includes the potential to set goals to achieve even higher small business capability in those portfolios, which then supports the department's larger goal of meeting small business total obligations. But we are definitely in tune with the fact that small business provides those services to us significantly. We are a significant buyer of those, and we want to keep that going and improve it as a percentage of our spend with small business.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, Mr. Brennan, we covered a lot of ground. I think this has been really helpful for our listeners. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. If they have any questions, we're trying to be as transparent as possible. If you would put up our webpage, I think that they'll be very interested and hopefully pleased with what we're trying to do in the department.
You bet. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Ken Brennan is the Deputy Director for Services in the Office of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. We will indeed post a link to the DPAP website and the new DoD instruction we've been talking about this hour on services acquisition. That'll be at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. And you can also listen back to this full interview in case you joined us late at that same address. That's going to do it for this week's program. Thanks as always for joining us. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.